Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
Welcome, everybody, to Erev Parsha Zachor. It is the eve of the Shabbos that has a nickname. One of probably 10. There are probably 10 Shabboses in the year that have a nickname. Like the first Shabbos after, when we start the new cycle, after Simchas Torah, is called Shabbos Bereishis. The Shabbos of Bereishis. So in addition to having a weekly Parsha, which every Shabbos does, it also has a nickname. So this Shabbos has a nickname. It's called Shabbos Zachor, the Shabbos of Remember. Because we are instructed by our sages to tack on an extra reading of a paragraph from a different Parsha than the weekly one, which in which the Torah exhorts us to always remember what our arch enemy Amalek, a descendant of Esav, did to us, and in a very real sense continues to do for us, to us, and therefore we must constantly remember, and we have to root out any traces of their influence, even in our lives today. That is always, this Shabbos always comes the Shabbos before Purim, because there's a very, very strong connection between Amalek and the Purim villains, because Haman himself was a descendant of Amalek. So what we're reading about, the story of the Esther and the salvation from our villains, and the salvation of Purim, is very, very much about Jews seeing and prevailing over the influence of Amalek and of the Hamans of the world. Very germane to what we've just been talking about, anti-Semitism, etc. So, because it is a Shabbos right before Purim, and because the Shabbos itself bears with it a pre-Purim message, I thought it might be appropriate to address our class today to Purim. And I have to remain faithful to the weekly Parsha, which is Tetzaveh. And so I have, before our source today, I have excerpted something that you will find interesting and maybe amusing, which will make that connection. The title of our class will be Parshas Tetzaveh Preceding Purim this year. So, not always does Shabbos Zachor coincide with Parshas Tetzaveh, although very often it does. But this year, Parshas Tetzaveh happens to be the Shabbos that precedes Purim. And we would like to, in general, explore the question, what is the power of this most celebrated day on the Jewish calendar? Let's try to deepen our understanding and appreciation of Purim. The Parsha quote is from 28:2. You shall make vestments of sanctity for Aaron your brother for glory and splendor. Let me read it in the Hebrew. That is pretty much at the beginning of Parshas Tetzaveh. The Asisa Vigde Kodesh La'aron Achicha L'chavod Ulasifares. Okay, so you shall make vestments of sanctity for Aaron your brother for glory and splendor. And this Parsha of Tetzaveh follows directly after Teruma, where we were instructed to make the Mishkan itself, the tabernacle, and of course the priests are going to be serving in the tabernacle, and they also have special garments that they wear. And the Torah describes these garments as providing glory and splendor, kavod and tiferes, two very, very descriptive words to these garments and to the Kohen himself. Now, what does this have to do with Purim? So we quote we quote a verse from Esther. And here I've got Esther in the back, so let me read that in Hebrew. Esther 1:4. The story of Esther opens up with a scene of a great grand party that King Ahasuerus throws for his kingdom. The party lasts for 180 days. That's a lot of drinking. And what did Ahasuerus do at this party? So this verse says, "Baharoso es osher kavod malchuso, es yukar tiferes gedulaso, yamim rabim shmonim umaas." Shmonim umaas yom. When Ahasuerus displayed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the splendor of his excellent majesty for many days. Ah, there are those words. Splendor, glorious kingdom, and the splendor of his excellent majesty. Glory and splendor. Sounds like Tetzaveh. So, quoting from Art Scroll, this is the Art Scroll commentary on the Book of Esther. He adorned himself with the Jewish priestly robes. Ahasuerus was wearing the priestly garments at his party? The word splendor used here is the same word used in connection with the priestly garments for glory and splendor, thus indicating that he wore robes looted from the Jews, from the Jews during the conquest by Nebuchadnezzar. Let's remember the sequence here. Nebuchadnezzar led the Babylonians to destroy the first temple. When they destroyed the temple, they looted all of the furnishings and all of the special robes. They carted it by boat to Babylon. Boat?
No.
By land. Okay, by wagon. To Babylon. They kept it in the king wherever they it wasn't Shushan in those days. There was maybe Baghdad, where Nebuchadnezzar had his capital. So it was in his palace.
Babel.
Is that the city Babel?
Yeah.
There was a city Babel. Yeah.
Yeah, Babylonia. Babel would have been the capital.
Okay. So it sits there on display until such time as the Persian Empire comes and defeats the Babylonians. Mm-hmm. And one of the Persian kings is Ahasuerus. Whoever conquers gets the palace and all of the treasures. So now Ahasuerus is in possession of these priestly garments. And so he's having this party, and he wants to show how great he is. Because, you know, Ahasuerus was not born into a royal family. He married into royal family. Mm-hmm. He married Vashti, who was the granddaughter of Nebuchadnezzar. And there was this competition between Ahasuerus and Vashti, because Ahasuerus was the king, but he was a self-made man. He was a warrior. And he became king. And his wife is the real thing. She is from royal blood. And so when Ahasuerus says to his servants, "Tell Vashti to come before me wearing her royal crown," she says, "Ah, who is this commoner telling me what to do? Me, the royalty." And that got him. That was a constant battle between them. So she put him in his place, and he put her in her place.
Is that a midrash?
Yes, there's a whole Talmud, a whole tractate about the inside story of the Megillah, and much commentary about that. So that's just a little aspect. Now he's trying to show how great he is, so naturally he is going to build himself up, and one of the ways he does that is by wearing the priestly garments. There you go. That is the Parsha connection to our class today. Maybe there's more to it, but at this point, I would like to take you with me to read something which is a very, very basic, uncomplicated, but very fundamental aspect of Purim. I wanted to find something that was contemporary. I wanted to find something that discussed one of the themes of Purim. And there are a number. A big one that I almost use is about Jewish unity. Because we're told that the way that the Jews spiritually overcame the peril that they were in was by joining together. Esther had requested, Lech Knos es Kol HaYehudim, gather all the Jews together. We are all in peril. And any differences that exist between Jew and Jew are all nullified because we're all in the same boat of doom. And it was that recognition that no matter what our differences are, we are all Jews. We are all have the same fate and the same destiny. Mm-hmm. That in and of itself was a spiritual attainment which allowed the decree to be overturned. So that's a big event, and of course our practices and customs on Purim of giving gifts and celebrating together and giving to the poor, these are all things which solidify the Jewish unity every year. But there's another, perhaps even more basic and more important theme about Purim, and that is the one that we will read in an excerpt by a contemporary rabbi, Rabbi Yisrael Miller. He's written several books. His first book was called In Search of the Jewish Woman. Mm-hmm. So have you read it?
That book at home. Yeah,
okay, it's a good read. But he also wrote a book in later years called A Gift for Yom Tov, where he tries to explain the significance of every holiday. And this is an excerpt of what he wrote about Purim. It was right on the website. All I had to do is cut it and paste it, and then whittle it down so it would fit on my page. Okay. I couldn't get Rabbi Yisrael Miller's birth year. I couldn't find him on the internet or on white pages, so he's a rabbi today. He was for many years in Pittsburgh. Now he's in Calgary, mm-hmm. Alberta. He's probably around 60 or so, is my guess.
Is he really into Rabbi Esther Miller at all?
Not that I know of.
He wrote two other books also.
What's Wrong with Being Happy?
And What's
yeah.
Wrong with Being Human, I think.
Aha. Uh-huh.
He's a great writer.
Good. Very good. Okay. We're blessed. Okay. After our nation was conquered and exiled and scattered, after the Holy Temple was demolished and the great national symbols were lost, after prophets and prophecy came to an end, then, for the first time, it became more difficult to believe. This is something which gave me a good feeling because it's a major realization that I've come to largely through the learning that we do here. In various different formats, we've shared the idea that the world has changed. And the presence of God has gone into hiding, and it is no longer manifest the same way, and therefore it's harder to believe. And Dr. Schultz always asks the question that God's presence is everywhere. And we were trying to explain the distinction between God's existence and the manifestation, the revelation of God's presence among people. That depends on people. So I was just listening to one of the older recordings, and Dr. Schultz raised the question, mm-hmm. Isn't God's presence everywhere? Mm-hmm. Let me just share this. We once cited a dialogue between the Rebbe of Kutsk and some of his disciples. You'll be very happy with this. He asks his disciples, where is God to be found? And the student said, Rebbe, what kind of question is that? God's glory fills the earth. And the Rebbe says, no. God's presence is to be found wherever man lets him in. Mm-hmm. And it's the same dialogue, it's the same question. God exists, but he's hidden to the point where the only way he will reveal himself is only in the minds and in the hearts of those that will allow him. And that's the state of the world. And what he's saying is that it didn't used to be that way. In the time when the temple stood and the prophets prophesied, we didn't have to let him in. He was just overflowing. But after that was gone, the Jews are now in Babylon. For the very first time, we have Hester Panim, we have hidden face, the hidden face of God. And that's the backdrop to the story of Purim. Yes.
Do we know when, maybe not exactly, but it says here, after the prophets and prophecy came to an end, when did that happen?
That's a very good point, because the prophets didn't really end until after the Purim story.
Were they still there, and maybe prophecy itself had been kind of...
It was, put it this way, it was on its way out. It was fading fast. There were still prophets until the very beginning of the Second Temple period, which is post-Purim. But he's speaking just in general terms that once prophecy ends, it's harder to believe. And already at the time of Purim, it was already, for a very large degree, prophecy had all but ended.
Yeah, traditionally it's supposed to end with Ezra.
Right.
Yeah, but he's at this time.
Ezra is,
and so I was wondering whether it happened
400 before.
Yeah, but that's this time. So I was wondering whether it was before Esther or right after Esther.
It's really right after Esther, but it's already we're already experiencing. Once the Jews are in exile, they're already experiencing the hiddenness. Mm-hmm. Okay, so at this time, the backdrop is it's harder to believe in God. Don't even ask me about nowadays. The Megillah does not mention the name of God, not even once. There are several reasons for this omission. One reason is the following. In earlier times, when all Israel felt the divine presence, there was no Purim, because Israel did not yet need it. Only after the loss of the Holy Temple, after national downfall and exile, when belief became more difficult and people began to wonder, did God give us Purim? Purim is a gift. Even if Jews who are unaware of any feelings of faith at all read the entire book of Esther thoughtfully, and that's easier said than done with all that noise, they will not be the same people they were when they began. The thoughtful reader will try to picture what it was like for the Jews to have lived in the days of Queen Esther. And now Rabbi Miller is going to tell us the Purim story. Imagine back then, all Jews everywhere are living in the Persian Empire under the control of Ahasuerus. The king delegates authority to the wicked Haman, and Haman decrees death for every one of us. Queen Esther, who, whether or not we knew her lineage, had always seemed to be a kindly person, has become Haman's good buddy, inviting him to private dinner parties. Our leader Mordechai is first on the list to be hanged. And for us and our families, there is no way out. Have we ever, in recent times, felt that a dark cloud looms over us? Like Israel is in trouble, like Jews worldwide are in trouble? Nothing like they felt then. I mean, It was already, war had broken out. It was plastered all over the billboards that the Jews are all going to be killed. We have never experienced the kind of terror.
We haven't, but the Holocaust is an example. They have, for sure.
You know what? In a sense, this was worse because the Holocaust Jews didn't know what was happening to them. Some did, but some didn't.
They did in Germany.
This was undeniable, and even those who did could have said, "No, it'll never happen. It'll be okay. Things will change." This was on the news that the decree was out. All Jews knew knew that they were going to be killed.
And they were all in one place.
And they were all in one place, and it wasn't like there are pockets here and pockets there. They were all in whatever provinces, 127 provinces that are scattered throughout. But they were all there. There were none left in Israel. And all of Jewry was going to be stamped out, and we knew it. Okay. Mordechai urges us to fast and to pray. Okay, Mordechai, interesting. He is the first on the wanted list, and he's not sitting there and biting his nails. He is getting up, and he's telling the Jews, come on, let's act. How are we going to act? Let's fast. Now, fasting doesn't mean let's go into a frenzy and let us become, out of control. Fasting means deliberate acts of repentance. Let us repent. Let us become, let us soul search. And let us look into our ways and our deeds. And we do that. That is facilitated better when you're fasting. And let us pray to God. He's teaching the people, you know, we have an old tradition. It's called davening. It's called praying. You know, our ancestors used to know that if you had a problem, you would get together in the synagogue and you would pray to God and God would hear us. So Mordechai he's not out of control. Haman shakes us up and he drops us at the door of the synagogue. We all followed him because we all felt that vulnerability. We pray and we fast for 3 days and 3 nights. How many have fainted from hunger and thirst, and how many have died? But we do it anyway, because there is no other way. There is still no real hope. There was nothing in the books, there was nothing in the realm of nature that we could have even guessed our way out of that. There was only one glimmer, except for the intuitive feeling that somewhere, perhaps, surely, we weren't sure. Some of us said maybe, some of us said surely, somehow, someone with a capital S hears. So that's what we're doing for 3 days and 3 nights. And then suddenly, the news breaks. Unbelievable. The unthinkable. Queen Esther is Jewish. We didn't even know that. She is one of us. King Ahasuerus has switched to our side. Wicked Haman is hanging on the gallows built for Mordechai. And Mordechai has been transferred from death row to the prime minister's throne. This happens within those 3 days, or at the end of 3 days. Can you believe it? In an astonishing reversal of fortune, Jews throughout the empire are receiving royal treatment. The anti-Semites are in hiding. Thousands of pagans are trying to convert to Judaism. It's written right in the story of Esther. The world has turned upside down. We rush to the streets, all of us dancing, shouting, laughing, and weeping all at the same time. The singing is spontaneous. Songs of thanks to God. And of course, we sing along as we laugh and we weep. Okay, so how do we feel? We're there. Let's transport ourselves to Shushan. This turn of events has just happened. Come on, cynics. Let's go, cynics. What do you think about? I don't mean us here. What are you thinking? Well, perhaps it was all nothing more than lucky coincidence. Perhaps it was just a lucky break that King Ahasuerus killed Queen Vashti in a drunken rage, and that he just happened to choose Esther as the replacement, a Jewish woman. And the king, who had always hated Jews, just happened to be in a good mood to grant Esther's request when she begged him to save us. Maybe it just happened that way. Yes, maybe. But no Jew dancing in the street, none of us who were there and who lived through it, believes that. Because there were no cynics at the time of Purim. That's the biggest miracle. Everybody believed in God at that moment. And now, that's the story of back then. What about today? Where are we? So Rav Miller continues, we have since celebrated over 2,300 Purims, and the holiday is today more relevant than ever. So many people are confused about their relationship with God and His Torah. Ever meet anyone that's confused about His relationship? No, we don't know people like that, right? How to feel the closeness, how to be strengthened by it. Purim opens a door for us with its mitzvah of reading the Megillah twice, even on the most superficial levels. You've done the mitzvah. As long as we read it, looking for some light, letting the story enter our bones by picturing ourselves and our families in that life and death situation, then we will come to know that things did not just happen, that there is no coincidence then, and most importantly, there is no coincidences today either. Purim is a day to relive the story, to fast and to pray. That is, the day before Purim is Tanis Esther, the fast of Esther. Extra prayers are recited. To read and to sing, to dance and to feast, and to offer toasts to God with a large glass of wine. To drink a little and to think a little. Conjuring up mental images of what it was like for our families to drink and to sing on that first Purim so many years ago, just like we just did today. And then we will discover that the special light given to Israel still shines, and the rope of faith is still within our reach, and that God is always with us, helping us to see and to hold on. That is the gift of Purim. When God had to, sadly, send us into exile, He said, but let me send you along with a little care package, and that care package is Purim, the Shalach Manif, if you will, and it will always be with you, and it will always shine the light as long as you are in exile until we get to come back home.
Wow.
And that's Purim. L'chaim.
So, in a way, you might say that the Holocaust is a sort of a to strengthen our faith in God. In a way, but has it?
Why would it? Why would it?
Because we're here. The Third Reich isn't. That's why.
Mm-hmm.
Israel survives.
Mm-hmm.
Am Yisrael Chai.
Yeah.
So you might say, well, that should give us reassurance. And yet there are so many people who say the Holocaust has destroyed our faith in God.
Right. We need to get the word of Purim out.
Well, the Holocaust didn't destroy our faith in God, but there were many people who we can't stand in their shoes, because if they individually lost faith, what they went through was like hard. But some of them kept their religion and became stronger.
That's what
you know,
some of them re-accepted it.
I stayed with Lila Perry in Israel on my trip. Her husband, Avishon, passed away 2 years ago, and he was a man that was a young boy, like in his teenage years, and he was really had a hard time, and he
Jack came back,
and he made Aliyah, and he talked. He didn't normally talk, but he talked on Schindler went around, and he had people give their stories.
Oh, wow.
And I didn't watch it.
Spielberg.
He also did Schindler, but he went around and he actually told his story, and I did not hear it, but I heard Rabbi Schlush talk about it because he was there in Israel at the time, and it was so unbelievable how he held on and what he went through.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Hmm.
So.
But this is there's a connection between Purim and the Holocaust, because they say that the sons of Haman, like those the ones that were at Eichmann's trial, one of them yelled out, what did he yell out?
Purim Fest.
Purim Fest, when they were, you know, all the sons of Haman were hung with Haman, and then the ones who were on trial at the Eichmann trial, I don't even know all the details.
No, it was the Nuremberg trial.
The Nuremberg trial?
Yeah, it was one man.
No, it was the Nuremberg trial.
And they were all sentenced in June, but they weren't hung until Hoshana Rabbah of that year.
October.
And at that time, one of them was getting ready to be hung, and he said, Purim Fest, whatever, 1946 or whatever.
Yeah,
and
he said,
what does that have to do with anything? Well, there were 10 people hanged that day, like the 10 sons of Haman. And
supposed to have been 11th, but he...
The 11th one was related to, to Haman's daughter, who threw herself out the window because he was a guy and he was found dressed in women's clothing. He had committed suicide.
Garen.
Wow.
Yeah. And the guy who said this was like the press guy, the propaganda guy.
PR?
Uh-huh. And he knew everything about the Jews and stuff like that. And Hoshana Rabbah is the Jewish day of putting the sentence down on the non-Jews.
Mm. Ah.
So that's why it was delayed from June to October.
Well, Goebbels was the propaganda guy.
Wow.
Yeah.
Shkala.
Yeah.
Wow. Cool.
That history. Wow.
Well, I've read that discovery thing. It's just I found it very, very powerful. And
very powerful. But you know, the Gulf War was over also on Purim. The Gulf War in 91. 91, 92. Yeah, the Gulf War, was January 15th or something of 92, I think it was. And it was over, that they danced in the streets on Purim.
Mm-hmm.
The threat from
Baghdad.
Know, yeah, from, yeah, right.
From the Persian Empire.
The Persian Empire was over. Now, this is not Kaini a coincidence. It's not a coincidence. It can't
Kaini
be a coincidence.
Kaini Hiratzon, may it be either will. Let's hear it from Varda for a second.
So I'll start out by saying that the way that I see it is that God actually wears two masks in the story of Purim, and so does his wife. And the Holocaust is to me the greatest sign in the course of history that the Moshiach has not made it into this world yet. And if we don't see that clearly, you know, and the world doesn't see that clearly, and people are walking around with blinders and bent and everything else.
Well, does anybody deny that?
Just Jewish people left this place.
Oh, you mean those that say he already came?
Oh.
Exactly.
That's what you mean.
Exactly. And to see that 5 million of their own exited at the same time, and Purim to me really is an indicator of the one and only holy war, though. Has ever will ever take place on the planet, that everything else has been over the land, even the Holocaust. Because if you research it, you'll see that the demon was after the land, and the Jewish people were just first, and he had no intention of stopping just with Jews. We were just first in line, and everybody was going with it. He was going to create an Aryan world, and here he is with black hair and a black mustache, and he wants all blind, blonde-haired people. You talk about sick. This is. It's not just demonic and mad. This is mental illness, and we live in a world that's filled with this mental illness that just gets perpetuated. And until people embrace the Torah and Torah law, we will not have a world full of sanity, because that's the only place where the sanity exists.
Hear, hear. What you said about we're still here and the Third Reich is not here, it reminded me of a story that somebody showed me in a book about Parsha Parables by Rabbi Mordechai Kamenetsky, that in the 1940s or 50s, there was a Rav from Europe that went to Israel. He was trying to rebuild yeshivas. It was a Rav Kahaneman, and he built the yeshiva in Bnei Brak, which is called Panovich, because that's where he came from. So, anyways, he is trying to solicit support for the building of a yeshiva. So he's traveling to Rome, and he finds out, somebody gets a message, you know, there's a wealthy doctor from Israel who happens to be in Rome too, maybe you could, you know, hook up with him. So he finds out his whereabouts, he goes to the hotel where the doctor is staying, and he asks, you know, for his room number, and he says, or he calls him, I guess, and he says, this is Rabbi Kahaneman, I'd like to meet with you, we have a very important mission to take care of. So he says, okay, I'll be ready soon. So he comes with a cab, and he takes the doctor in a cab, and he tells the driver, Ark de Titus, take us to the Arch of Titus. So he drives him there, and the rabbi gets out, and he was apparently a tremendous character, like a real personality. He gets out of the cab with the doctor, and he goes over to the Arch of Titus, and he says, Titus, here am I. Where are you? Now, Titus was the Roman general that destroyed the Second Temple. You're just a statue. This is all that remains of you. I'm still here. The Jewish people are still here. We are surviving. We are building. We are rebuilding. We're still studying the Torah. Here am I. Where are you? It was in Yiddish.
Mir sein und da.
Mir sein und da. Wo bist du? And then with that, he says to the doctor, let's go. And they got into the cab and he brought him back to his hotel. And that was it. The mission was, let us realize that Am Yisrael Chai, that we are going to live forever, and let's rebuild, and please help me.
Rabbi Silverman says it's the same thing in a slightly different way. He said, when you go shopping in Tocqueville,
yeah,
you see the stores filled with Jews. You don't see any Babylonians.
You only see baloney. No Babylonians. Ah, very good. Yashuko. Anybody else?
Yeah, as far as the arch, I happened to be in Rome maybe 50 or so years ago.
Did you do what the Romans do? Did you do what the Romans do when you were in Rome?
In the Arch of Titus, you know, they have that little bas relief where it says Judea Capita.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, which means whatever it means in Latin.
What does it mean?
I guess it means
Jews have been captured.
Oh, capture.
Shows the Roman soldiers marching with the menorah on their shoulders.
Yeah, yeah.
Somebody had to feed on the wall of the arch, Am Yisrael Chai.
Ah.
They took it off. I mean, you know.
Uh-huh.
That's not nice.
Rubbing salt in the wounds. Right. Uh-huh. Okay, have a wonderful Shabbos and a Freilach Purim will be uplifted from Purim.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.